You're listening to a Scottish Poetry Library podcast.
The Scottish Constitution. It must contain silver sands. It must hold water in the shape of lochans, hydro dams, and firths. It must be just, in the sense both of perjink and even-handed, shaking hands with all. It must be old, with the wisdom of the rookie. It needs to know its onions, has to laugh and dance at weddings, all recriminations, silky stories, fiscal memoranda. It must be shy, tongue-tied, then eloquent, catching your eye and holding it forever, however far you go, to whatever shores, atolls or cities, it must hold you fast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Scottish Poetry Library podcast. My name is Colin Waters. Normally I'm the communications manager at the SPL, but for the next half hour I shall be your host. Our guest today is Robert Crawford. Robert is a poet, which is why we're speaking to him, but he's also published a number of other books, including The Bard, a biography of Robert Burns, and he's also written extensively about T.S. Eliot. A generation or two of students know him as a professor at the School of English in the University of St. Andrews, which is where I first encountered him. And how strange is it now, several years later, to be sitting here being the one posing questions to him instead of, as it used to be, the other way around. His most recent collection is Testament, and that was published by Jonathan Cape. And as you'll hear over the course of the podcast, that title can be interpreted in a number of ways. Robert and I discuss a number of topics, from religious poetry to the late Mick Imlay, but we start by talking about Scotland and political poetry. Let's start by talking about the political poems in Testament. There's quite a few. They would be dealing partly, I guess, with Scottish identity. There's the poem called Dave Hart, which is about our dear national leader, David Cameron. Do you worry, perhaps, that maybe dealing with such specific historical characters might date them, or is there something else you're after?
I think that's a risk. It's only one section of the book that has these directly political poems, but I certainly did want to try to write to this particular important moment in Scottish political and cultural history. I love the way Burns was able to write poems that had a direct political engagement. Only some of his work has that, but it's certainly there. I like the idea of a poetry that can be political, can have a public voice, can have other voices too, but can have a public voice and can engage with what's going on in the society. So I wanted to try and do that in one part of this book. The poems may date. The truth is that a lot of the poems were written maybe about 2 years before the book came out. So there's a kind of second guessing maybe going on in some of them. The section that they're in is called A Little History. And so after the 18th of September 2014, they will form A Little History. Before that date, which is when we're speaking just now, perhaps the phrase A Little History sounds just slightly different. And I suppose I wanted the poems to operate in kind of live action just now, but also I would hope to stand up in the longer term.
It's an unfair question, the one I asked in some ways, because on the one hand, you know, you get asked, will these poems date? But on the other hand, poets are quite often berated for dwelling in an ivory tower and not wanting to sort of get their hands dirty and talk about what's going on.
I think political poetry is perhaps not the most fashionable kind of poetry at the moment. And maybe there are several kinds of unfashionable poetry in the book. There's some religious poetry there, for instance. But the book is just trying to do a number of different things. Often I think some of the poets whose work I admire most, whether it's Burns or William Dunbar or Les Murray or Edwin Morgan, they're writing is quite diverse. I like the idea of a plurality of voices, even in one book, rather than books that just have one particular theme or voice that runs through it. I like a sense of diversity in books.
It's interesting that, according to a radio programme I listened to recently, most Scottish artists of one description or another have opted to say yes to independence. But I don't think, apart from yourself and from a poem that I read by, or was read to me by Liz Lockhead, I haven't read a sort of great upswell of political poetry, actually. And interestingly, Liz's poem took Burns. It was almost like a monologue by Burns, actually, in which he was coming out for independence. And you bring Burns into the book as well. There's about his footwear, if I remember rightly. But you mentioned Burns when you were discussing sort of framework for why you would be interested in writing political poetry.
Yes, that's a kind of, the poem Burnswear, which is indeed about Burns' footwear, is a kind of ironic or sarky poem in the book. But I have a deep love of Burns, and it is his way of engaging with a democratic voice that I think is one of the most wonderful things about his poetry. So I suppose I just wanted to try a wee bit of that in the 21st century. I think you're right that a lot of writers generally in Scotland are likely to vote for independence, or said they are voting for independence, but there possibly isn't as much political poetry. That may just be because, for whatever reason, in Britain as a whole, I think political poetry has fallen rather out of fashion.
You started writing, you're being published rather, I think, in the 80s. So you were writing initially in the period after the devolution referendum had failed. Do you remember there being a certain atmosphere at that time?
Yes, if I'm honest, I'd have to say I voted against devolution. I think it was the first time I'd had the vote in 1979, and I certainly wasn't in favour of devolution. I then went off to live in the south of England for 6 years and realised that really I had come from a different country, and this made me think about Scotland in a way I hadn't thought about it at all when I'd grown up here. And I was conscious then, books were coming out while I was living down south. Alistair Gray's Lanark, Douglas Dunn's St Kilda's Parliament, Edwin Morgan's Sonnets from Scotland. Yes, so there was a kind of cultural pushback against the sort of Thatcherite and orthodoxy that seemed to be carrying all before it south of the border. So yes, I was formed, I think, in that period to a fair degree in terms of poetry, and perhaps even more so in terms of politics. So that's always been important to me. I think I'm slightly wary of being stereotyped as someone who just writes about Scottish politics or even just about Scottish stuff, but it is undeniable that I have written a lot about Scottish material. I care a lot about Scotland and I love Scottish poetry. And yet the poet who meant most to me, certainly in my teens, and still perhaps means as much, if not more, to me than any other, is T.S. Eliot, who's not necessarily renowned for his ardent support of Scottish causes. Dave Hart. St. George o' Osborne to his richt, and Sam Cam by his side, Dave Hart has ridden through the nicht to flatter Scotland's pride. He sings the joys o' union lang and loud through shitty weather. His een are bricht, his voice is strang, we're better off thegither. Oh, Dave Hart, man, bewore the wiles of slippery smart Alex, whose henchfolk maybe seem o' smiles, but sound like Gallic Daleks. Oh, Dave Hart, will ye muster men at Cumnock or Port Seton? Nae every battle's won, ye ken, on the playing fields o' Eton. The paps o' Jura are your ain, though nae the chaps o' Govan. The faithful met in Bearsden's reign look awfu' like a coven. Dave Hart, your michty sword aloft shines like a nuclear weapon. But as ye gang by coo and croft, tap ten to what ye step on. Welcome to Scotland, as is said by yon old guy in Skyfall. Our leaders thrawn and overfed, our sceneries an eyeful. For a' the cabinets ye've cheered, trust neither man nor woman. We arena scared, we're just prepared. The Camerons are coming.
One of the many interesting things about T.S. Eliot, of course, is that he wrote religious poetry. And you mentioned earlier in our chat that you were writing some religious poetry yourself. What was the inspiration? What was it that caused you to turn to this at this point?
I'm not sure I see it as something that I've turned to. I think it's been there from time to time in earlier things that I've written. And I would love to say that this was coming out of some deep faith. But I think probably, if anything, it was coming as much from uncertainty and doubt. A sense of not necessarily having lost any faith I have, but certainly having misplaced it for a bit. And yet thinking that the New Testament in particular, passages of it, which I've known, not that I could recite them, but I have heard since and read since my childhood, were hugely, resonantly important to me. So I saw the other day R.S. Thomas on a television programme talking about Christ as being a poet. And although I wouldn't quite have put it that way, it does seem to me often that the words of Christ in the New Testament are pretty close to being poems, are very metaphorically resonant, have a lyricism, sometimes a disconcerting quality too, that runs through them, which makes them very close to poetry. So in this book, There are a number of poems which are really paraphrases of New Testament passages, but what they do is they run a kind of thread of rhyme through what may be for many people quite familiar, for other people less familiar, passages from the New Testament, and just try and bring out the latent poetry that is there and feed off it and try and develop it in a way that I hope will resonate with readers, whether or not they have a particular religious commitment. I suppose I see the Christ in the New Testament as a rather disturbing figure, not quite as a terrorist, but certainly as a troubling, sometimes quite extreme figure, and wanted to introduce a sense of lyricism as well as a sense of discomfort maybe into passages that might seem sometimes perhaps too familiar to us.
The thing that connects the political and the religious is, you know, the title we have here, Testament. This is a book about different kinds of testaments, isn't it?
Yes, the title of the book was there for quite some time, I think, as it was taking shape. It just seemed to me that there are also sort of family poems in the book, there are love poems in the book. Just a way of trying to, it's not that I'm proposing to snuff it tomorrow, but to pass on things that had a particular kind of importance to me and that I wanted to pass on in an almost testamentary way. Writer. When the young married woman who slept around was brought to him, he wrote on the ground with his finger. Then the men said, "Our law demands she be stoned." He went on writing on the ground as if in the middle of a poem. They lingered, nagging him, "What do you say?" Till he lifted himself to full height and spoke, "Hey, I want one of you clever men who has never sinned to chuck the first rock." Then he began to write again on the ground until one by one they started to walk away, so he and the woman were left alone. He spoke, "Lass, the oldest man went first, the youngest last. I think now, today, justice is done." She saw how it was just as he said, no accuser remained. And she heard him add, "Go, if you sinned before, sin no more."
Let's talk about those family and love poems at the start. There are some beautiful images. I think the last poem in the section is very striking, about the candle. Is that from an actual, another text?
Yes, the poem is called Persian, and it is a translation of an ancient Persian poem, the Bustan of Sadi. Sadi, a famous poet from Iran. Occasionally, in some of the stuff that I've been writing in the last few years, I suppose there's a desperate wish to write about stuff that isn't Scottish, you know? And that strikes me as a not ignoble impulse in someone who does write about Scotland a lot. I also admire, I think, the eroticism in some aspects of Eastern poetry. I'm not sure, although Burns is probably the greatest writer of love songs in English, it's not always that Scottish poetry is renowned for its eroticism. So having a strong vein of eroticism in the book was something that mattered to me personally, but I also thought was a good thing to do culturally as well. This poem's called Persian, and it ends with a translation of a poem. Persian. I long to catch you at Waverley Station. I see you with my eyes shut tight. As soon as I enter a crowded room, I know you are there. I steel myself against rushing to stand at your nape. From the Bustan of Sadi, I woke one night so alert I could hear a moth whisper to a candle, I am your lover, burn me, why are you crying? Till the candle replied, love is not for you, fire scares you, I have to stand erect till I melt to zero, I may scorch your wings, my own flame consumes me. Head to foot. A nightingale floor is, I think, a phrase I pinched from a James Bond novel. As I understand it, it's a floor in a Japanese house that is so delicately fitted together so that as soon as someone walks onto it, it creaks or sings. So their presence, their approach, their coming is kind of sung by the floor. It's to alert you. It's very, very sensitive to touch. So that's why this poem is called Nightingale Floor. Nightingale Floor. Odalisque, so pendulous and slim, as I nibble and lick your oxter, glutted with the rush of your curves, I imagine us as a nightingale floor, all perfect plainness, tiny cries born from surprise, ecstatic danger, dovetailed with joiner work of love, as we fit together, tongue and groove.
Well, it's interesting you start with a very, physically ecstatic sort of poem, Nightingale Floor, and then you've got this spiritual ecstasy at the end.
It's probably also, I think, a physical ecstasy or a mixture of agony and ecstasy at the end as well. Hard to know how to interpret some of those poems from other traditions. You know, sometimes they seem like religious poems, sometimes they seem like erotic poems, sometimes they seem like both. I quite like the mixture of the two. I mean, that's there in the Bible as well, in something like the Song of Songs, but it's not always what people immediately think of as so central in Christian tradition.
I mean, the common currency, both those poems, Red, the last poem, and Nightingale Floor, isn't it?
Yes, the first poem is called Nightingale Floor.
It's touch, I suppose, isn't it? This idea is touch.
Yes. Working as an intellectual, if you like, as a university teacher, I think it's important in poetry to have a full sense of the somatic, the bodily. And I was conscious that I wanted to develop that in some of these poems. So the poems should have in various senses, in terms of touch, in terms of acoustic as well, a sense of being full-bodied.
By curious coincidence, as I was saying to you earlier on, this is the second interview that I've done within a few days in which there's been a poem about and dedicated to Scottish poet Mick Imla, who is a friend and collaborator of yours. For anyone who doesn't know his work, could you talk about Mick Imla?
Well, one of the interesting things was he Scottish or not? He wanted very much to be Scottish, and he said in biographical notes in his own collections that he was born in Aberdeen. Someone told me he was really born in Lewisham, but he spent some of his early childhood in Scotland. I got to know him. I never knew him very well, but I got to know him a bit because he was my second editor when I was published by what's now part of Random House. And I had read some of his poetry before and liked it and realised that he was a very, very good editor. You know, he was the kind of person who would spot tiny repeats in poems and ask you, do you really want that repeated word there? Were you quite conscious of that? And, you know, he would scrutinise poems closely. And I knew he was very interested in not just Scottish literature, but some of the writers that I too had been, and in some cases still am interested in, particularly James Thomson, a Victorian poet from Port Glasgow who grew up, like Mick, in London. And like Mick, had a drink problem, had a number of kind of shared preoccupations, I think, with Mick. Wrote The City of Dreadful Night. I had almost written a PhD on James Thomson at one point. So that in rather odd ways, Mick and I, although we were very different people, if you met Mick, you'd never have thought he had any Scottish connection. Sounded and was an English public schoolboy. But we had a number of interests in common. And so I'd meet him over the years, and to cut a middle-sized story short, we ended up editing this Penguin Book of Scottish Verse together, which was a great thing to do. It had originally been his contract, and then I think I eventually realised that he hadn't actually done anything very much. But as he put it to me at the time, he didn't feel that the book should be edited wholly from London. He needn't have been generous in that regard in terms of bringing me on board. He worked as the poetry editor of the Times Literary Supplement. In a sense, he didn't need any help from me. But I had quite decided ideas about what I wanted the book to be like. I knew I wanted it to open with this long Latin poem translated by Edwin Morgan, the Altus Prosator, a poem attributed to Columba. And so when he invited me aboard, I was able to kind of change, perhaps. I think he would have started with William Dunbar, which struck me as a bit disappointing place to start. So we kind of reoriented the book and worked on it together, though I think I did quite a lot of the work. Mick was a very elusive character. You know, you would phone up his workplace and they would always say, oh, he's not in yet, or no, he's not at his desk, or whatever. And he really lived this elusive life, which is there in some of his poems too. You can tell that. And then he got motor neurone disease and he died fairly rapidly. I got terribly upset because I went to my book full volume and his collection, The Last Leader, was they were both shortlisted for a prize, and there was a reception at something. There was a reading in the Queen Elizabeth Hall, and of course Mick wasn't able to be there and read. And I remember saying how annoying this was. And then when we went to the reception, the news had just come through that he'd just died. And I was awfully upset about that somehow. It was the first time that a poet pal of mine from my own generation, because he was just slightly older than I was, and whom I had known reasonably well and been quite close to co-editing this book, had died. So all that is a very long-winded way of trying to explain why there's not just one but two poems in Testament. One about Mick and one sort of dedicated to his memory. I wanted to write these elegies and felt like there had been a lot of elegies to him published. He was a widely admired poet, and I think he's a poet who's quite important, not least to a number of younger poets in London, probably less so to poets in Scotland, but I'm aware of poets in London to whom his work really has mattered a lot. I just wanted to kind of pay my tribute from the angle I'd known him from, which was a Scottish angle, rather than a particularly London or even a particularly Oxford angle. Mick Imla. The day you died, I stared up at the grey dome of St. Paul's, then caught the sleeper north, dourly imagining your own departure from London as your last pained way to stay elusive, Mick, Oxonian, Aberdonian, sly Doric, fitted up by your posh voice, your sports star, film noir, flaneur's lushness, spooked by the meth-kissed phantom city of dreadful night. I have your stoic email, a few postcards nibwork. When I think of your dark ink, what flits back is the sound of a fife blackbird singing the day I first heard you were ill. One drop-dead Orpheus, though I could not spot it. And when I tried to, then its song just stopped.
Let's talk about another poet who features in Testament, Cavafy.
Mm.
You've done translations of his work into Scots.
Yep.
What attracted you to Cavafy?
I love the poems. I studied Greek at school and for a year in my first year at university. And so, although I can't read modern Greek, I can make some sense of it if I have a parallel text. And I'd read Cavafy and Sepheris when I was in my late teens. And at that time, I liked Sepheris better than Cavafy. I love the stuff about the sea and the kind of lyricism in Sepheris. But now, for some reason, although I'm still quite interested in Sepheris, when I go back and try and read them, they just seem to me a bit overblown. Whereas Cavafy has a kind of more pared-down, spare quality that makes him perhaps easier to bring over into English or into Scots. And to me, that love of Cavafy, which is almost lifelong in me now, that has lasted. I wish my love of Sepheris had lasted to the same degree, but it hasn't quite. So for a long time, I'd wanted to try and make some versions of Cavafy. And then it just clicked that these should be in Scots. I wish I could have made more versions of Cavafy. There are maybe about 10 of them in this book. I would like to have done a whole book of Cavafy in Scots, though probably no one would have been mad enough to publish it. It's just sometimes, there's some particular poems that I felt attuned to and that I kind of clicked with and thought, yes, I can make something of that. So the ones that are here in the book Testament are those. I just think they're very strong, wonderful poems.
I'm just trying to imagine Cavafy in Scotland.
Well, that's what the poems do. Yeah. You know, the poems use the word Edinburgh rather than, say, citing them in Alexandria, where he lived and moved and had his being. The poems are bound up with some things that I'm attached to in Scotland, I suppose. But they are fairly close versions of the Cavafy originals, nonetheless.
So that's it for another edition of the SPL podcast. My thanks to Robert Crawford, who came down to the SPL on our particularly Greek day in August. I'm sure he had 100 other things he could have been doing, so we're very thankful he took time out to talk to us. The name again of his latest collection is Testament, and it's published by Jonathan Cape. Now, moving on, if you're interested in all things to do with the SPL, you can keep up with what we're doing in between podcasts by having a look at our Twitter stream, which is named By Leaves We Live, at By Leaves We Live. And we have a Facebook page too as well. Our website is www.scottishpoetrylibrary.org.uk. And if you visit that website, you'll find all sorts of poetry goodies to be had, from downloadable posters, give your fridge a treat and stick one of those up on it. And we also have lots of other podcasts featuring poets from all around the world. We've just published our autumn events brochure, I should mention, and that's stuffed with events that you might like to come to if you're living in the central belt of Scotland or near Edinburgh, somewhere like that. We've got all kinds of events featuring the likes of Michael Longley, Don Patterson and Kate Tempest. So go online and find out what we're doing, or pop into the SPL and pick up a brochure that way. In the meantime, I shall say farewell to you and leave you with Robert Crawford again, who ends the show by reading one of his Cavafy translations.
This is one of Cavafy's most famous poems, Tichy in Greek, Walls. I'll read it first in a kind of English prose version, and then I'll read it in the Scots verse. Walls. With no kindness, no pity, not a sideways glance of shame, they have built walls all around me, strong and high. And now I crouch here, despair nibbling my heart. I cannot see past this disaster. I'm exhausted, I'm dreary. I had so much still to get on with out there. All those days when they built the walls, how come I did not realise? It's stupid. But I never heard those builders, not one soft sound, though absolutely surely, bit by bit, they have cut me off. Was. We nae obligement, nae pity, nae a sclent o' shame, they've biggit was around me, strang and heech. And now a hunker here, one hope chitlin' my wame. I canna see past this weird. I'm done. I'm dreich. I'd say muckle to be dain still out by. O' yon days they biggit the wars. Who come I didna ken? It's daft. But I never heard yon biggers. Nae a saft soon. But gae certie, bit by bit, they've snipped me off.
Thank you for downloading this Scottish Poetry Library podcast. For further information about the Scottish Poetry Library, visit our website at www.scottishpoetrylibrary.org.uk, follow us on Twitter at @ByLeavesWeLive, and find us on Facebook.